and keep an eye on his mother, a position he had been groomed for summer after summer. A maintenance man at Ruby Pier. Eddie never said this, not to his wife, not to his mother, not to anyone. But he cursed his father for dying and for trapping him in the very life he'd been trying to escape. A life that, as he heard the old man laughing from the grave, apparently now was good enough for him. Today is Eddie's birthday. He is 37. His breakfast is getting cold.
"You see any salt?"
Eddie asks Noel. Noel, chewing a mouthful of sausage, slides out from the booth, leans across another table, and grabs a salt shaker. "Here," he mumbles. "Happy birthday." Eddie shakes it hard.
"How tough is it to keep salt on the table?"
"What are you, the manager?" Noel says. Eddie shrugs. The morning is already hot and thick with humidity. This is their routine, breakfast once a week, Saturday mornings, before the park gets crazy. Noel works in the dry cleaning business. Eddie helped him get the contract for Ruby Pier's maintenance uniforms.
"What do you think of this good-looking guy?" Noel says.
He has a copy of Life magazine open to a photo of a young political candidate.
"How can this guy run for president? He's a kid."
Eddie shrugs.
"He's about our age."
"No fooling," Noel says. He lifts an eyebrow.
"I thought you had to be older to be president." "We are older," Eddie mumbles.
Noel closes the magazine. His voice drops.
"Hey, you hear what happened to Brighton?"
Eddie nods. He sips his coffee. He'd heard. An amusement park, a gondola ride. Something snapped. A mother and her son fell 60 feet to their death.
"You know anybody up there?" Noel asks.
Eddie puts his tongue between his teeth. Every now and then he hears these stories, an accident at a park somewhere, and he shudders as if a wasp just flew by his ear. Not a day passes that he doesn't worry about it happening here, at Ruby Pier, under his watch.
"Nah," he says, "I don't know no one in Brighton."
He fixes his eyes out the window as a crowd of beachgoers emerges from the train station. They carry towels, umbrellas, wicker baskets with sandwiches wrapped in paper. Some even have the newest thing, foldable chairs made from lightweight aluminum. An old man walks past in a Panama hat, smoking a cigar.
"Look at that guy," Eddie says. "I promise you, he'll drop that cigar on the boardwalk."
"Yeah," Noel says, "so?"
"It falls in the cracks, then it starts to burn. You can smell it. The chemical they put in the wood, it starts smoking right away. Yesterday I grabbed a kid, couldn't have been more than 4 years old, about to put a cigar butt in his mouth."
Noel makes a face.
"And?"
Eddie turns aside.
"And nothing. People should be more careful, that's all."
Noel shovels a forkful of sausage into his mouth.
"You're a barrel of laughs. You always this much fun on your birthday?"
Eddie doesn't answer. The old darkness has taken a seat alongside him. He is used to it by now, making room for it the way you make room for a commuter on a crowded bus. He thinks about the maintenance load today, broken mirror in the funhouse, new fenders for the bumper cars. Glue, he reminds himself, gotta order more glue. He thinks about those poor people in Brighton. He wonders who's in charge up there.
"What time you finish today?" Noel asks.
Eddie exhales.
"It's gonna be busy. Summer, Saturday, you know."
Noel lifts an eyebrow.
"We can make the track by 6.
Eddie thinks about Marguerite. He always thinks about Marguerite when Noel mentions the horse track.
"Come on, it's your birthday," Noel says.
Eddie pokes a fork at his eggs, now too cold to bother with.
"All right," he says.
Chapter 12. The third lesson. "Was the pier so bad?" the old woman asked.
"It wasn't my choice," Eddie said, sighing. "My mother needed help. One thing led to another. Years passed. I never left. I never lived nowhere else. Never made any real money. You know how it is. You get used to something. People rely on you. One day you wake up and you can't tell Tuesday from Thursday. You're doing the same boring stuff. You're a ride man, just like
Your father?
Eddie said nothing.
He was hard on you, the old woman said.
Eddie lowered his eyes. Yeah, so?
Perhaps you were hard on him, too.
I doubt it. You know the last time he talked to me?
The last time he tried to strike you.
Eddie shot her a look. And you know the last thing he said to me? Get a job. Some father, huh?
The old woman pursed her lips. You began to work after that. You picked yourself up.
Eddie felt a rumbling of anger. Look, he snapped. You didn't know the guy.
That's true, she rose. But I know something you don't. And it is time to show you. Ruby pointed with the tip of her parasol and drew a circle in the snow. When Eddie looked into the circle, he felt as if his eyes were falling from their sockets and traveling on their own, down a hole and into another moment. The images sharpened. It was years ago, in the old apartment. He could see front and back, above and below. This is what he saw. He saw his mother looking concerned, sitting at the kitchen table. He saw Mickey Shea sitting across from her. Mickey looked awful. He was soaking wet, and he kept rubbing his hands over his forehead and down his nose. He began to sob. Eddie's mother brought him a glass of water. She motioned for him to wait and walked to the bedroom and shut the door. She took off her shoes and her house dress. She reached for a blouse and a skirt. Eddie could see all the rooms, but he could not hear what the two of them were saying. It was just blurred noise. He saw Mickey in the kitchen, ignoring the glass of water, pulling a flask from his jacket and swigging from it. Then, slowly, he got up and staggered to the bedroom. He opened the door. Eddie saw his mother, half-dressed, turn in surprise. Mickey was wobbling. She pulled the robe around her. Mickey came closer. Her hand went out instinctively to block him. Mickey froze just for an instant, then grabbed that hand and grabbed Eddie's mother and backed her into the wall, leaning against her, grabbing her waist. She squirmed and yelled and pushed on Mickey's chest while still gripping her robe. He was bigger and stronger, and he buried his unshaven face below her cheek, smearing tears on her neck. Then the front door opened, and Eddie's father stood there, wet from rain, a ball-peen hammer hanging from his belt. He ran into the bedroom and saw Mickey grabbing his wife. Eddie's father hollered. He raised the hammer. Mickey put his hands over his head and charged to the door, knocking Eddie's father sideways. Eddie's mother was crying, her chest heaving, her face streamed with tears. Her husband grabbed her shoulders. He shook her violently. Her robe fell. They were both screaming. Then Eddie's father left the apartment, smashing a lamp with the hammer on his way out. He thumped down the steps and ran off into the rainy night.
What was that? Eddie yelled in disbelief. What the hell was that?
The old woman held her tongue. She stepped to the side of the snowy circle and drew another one. Eddie tried not to look down. He couldn't help it. He was falling again, becoming eyes at a scene. This is what he saw. He saw a rainstorm at the farthest edge of Ruby Pier, the North Point, they called it, a narrow jetty that stretched far out into the ocean. The sky was a bluish black. The rain was falling in sheets. Mickey Shea came stumbling toward the edge of the jetty. He fell to the ground, his stomach heaving in and out. He lay there for a moment, face to the darkened sky, then rolled on his side, under the wood railing. He dropped into the sea. Eddie's father appeared moments later, scrambling back and forth, the hammer still in his hand. He grabbed the railing, searching the waters. The wind blew the rain in sideways. His clothes were drenched and his leather tool belt was nearly black from the soaking. He saw something in the waves. He stopped, pulled off the belt, yanked off one shoe, tried to undo the other, gave up, squatted under the railing and jumped, splashing clumsily in the churning ocean. Mickey was bobbing in the insistent roll of seawater, half unconscious, a foamy yellow fluid coming from his mouth. Eddie's father swam to him, yelling into the wind. He grabbed Mickey. Mickey swung. Eddie's father swung back. The skies clapped with thunder as the rainwater pelted them. They grabbed and flailed in the violent chop. Mickey coughed hard as Eddie's father grabbed his arm and hooked it over his shoulder. He went under, came up again, then braced his weight against Mickey's body, pointing them toward shore. He kicked. They moved forward. A wave swept them back, then forward again. The ocean thumped and crashed. but Eddie's father remained wedged under Mickey's armpit, pumping his legs, blinking wildly to clear his vision. They caught the crest of a wave and made sudden progress shoreward. Mickey moaned and gasped. Eddie's father spit out seawater. It seemed to take forever, the rain popping, the white foam smacking their faces, the two men grunting, thrashing their arms. Finally, a high curling wave lifted them up and dumped them onto the sand, and Eddie's father rolled out from under Mickey and was able to hook his hands under Mickey's arms and hold him from being swept into the surf. When the waves receded, he yanked Mickey forward with a final surge, then collapsed on the shore, his mouth open, filling with wet sand. Eddie's vision returned to his body. He felt exhausted, spent, as if he had been in that ocean himself. His head was heavy. Everything he thought he'd known about his father, he didn't seem to know anymore.
"What was he doing?" Eddie whispered.
"Saving a friend," Ruby said. Eddie glared at her.
"Some friend. If I'd have known what he did, I'd have let his drunken hide drown."
"Your father thought about that, too," the old woman said. "He had chased after Mickey to hurt him, perhaps even to kill him. But in the end, he couldn't. He knew who Mickey was. He knew his shortcomings. He knew he drank. He knew his judgment faltered. But many years earlier, when your father was looking for work, it was Mickey who went to the pier owner and vouched for him. And when you were born, it was Mickey who lent your parents what little money he had to help pay for the extra mouth to feed. Your father took old friendships seriously."
"Hold on, lady," Eddie snapped. "Did you see what that bastard was doing with my mother?"
"I did," the old woman said sadly. "It was wrong. But things are not always what they seem. Mickey had been fired that afternoon. He'd slept through another shift, too drunk to wake up, and his employers told him that was enough. He handled the news as he handled all bad news, by drinking more, and he was thick with whiskey by the time he reached your mother. He was begging for help. He wanted his job back. Your father was working late, and your mother was going to take Mickey to him. Mickey was coarse, but he was not evil. At that moment, he was lost, adrift, and what he did was an act of loneliness and desperation. He acted on impulse, a bad impulse. Your father acted on impulse, too. And while his first impulse was to kill, his final impulse was to keep a man alive." She crossed her hands over the end of her parasol. "That was how he took ill, of course. He lay there on the beach for hours, soaking and exhausted, before he had the strength to struggle home. Your father was no longer a young man. He was already in his 50s.
56,
Eddie said blankly. 56, the old woman repeated. His body had been weakened. The ocean had left him vulnerable. Pneumonia took hold of him, and in time, he died.
"Because of Mickey?"
Eddie said. "Because of loyalty," she said.
"People don't die because of loyalty."
"They don't?" She smiled. "Religion? Government? Are we not loyal to such things, sometimes to the death?" Eddie shrugged. "Better," she said, "to be loyal to one another." After that, the two of them remained in the snowy mountain valley for a long time. At least to Eddie it felt long. He wasn't sure how long things took anymore.
"What happened to Mickey Shea?" Eddie said.
"He died, alone, a few years later," the old woman said. "Drank his way to the grave. He never forgave himself for what happened."
"But my old man,"
Eddie said, rubbing his forehead.
"He never said anything."
"He never spoke of that night again. Not to your mother, not to anyone else. He was ashamed for her, for Mickey, for himself. In the hospital, he stopped speaking altogether. Silence was his escape. But silence is rarely a refuge. His thoughts still haunted him. One night his breathing slowed and his eyes closed and he could not be awakened. The doctor said he had fallen into a coma." Eddie remembered that night. Another phone call to Mr. Nathanson. Another knock on his door. "After that, your mother stayed by his bedside, days and nights. She would moan to herself softly, as if she were praying. I should have done something. I should have done something.
Finally, one night at the doctor's urging, she went home to sleep. Early the next morning, a nurse found your father slumped halfway out the window.
Wait, Eddie said.
His eyes narrowed.
The window.
Ruby nodded. Sometime during the night, your father awakened. He rose from his bed, staggered across the room, and found the strength to raise the window sash. He called your mother's name with what little voice he had. And he called yours, too, and your brother Joe. And he called for Mickey. At that moment, it seemed, his heart was spilling out, all the guilt and regret. Perhaps he felt the light of death approaching. Perhaps he only knew you were all out there somewhere in the streets beneath his window. He bent over the ledge. The night was chilly. The wind and damp, in his state, were too much. He was dead before dawn. The nurses who found him dragged him back to his bed. They were frightened for their jobs, so they never breathed a word. The story was, he died in his sleep. Eddie fell back stunned. He thought about that final image, his father, the tough old war horse, trying to crawl out a window. Where was he going? What was he thinking? Which was worse when left unexplained, a life or a death?
How do you know all this?
Eddie asked Ruby. She sighed. Your father lacked the money for a hospital room of his own. So did the man on the other side of the curtain. She paused. Emil. My husband. Eddie lifted his eyes. His head moved back as if he'd just solved a puzzle.
Then you saw my father.
Yes.
And my mother.
I heard her moaning on those lonely nights. We never spoke. But after your father's death, I inquired about your family. When I learned where he had worked, I felt a stinging pain, as if I had lost a loved one myself. The pier that bore my name. I felt its cursed shadow, and I wished again that it had never been built. That wish followed me to heaven, even as I waited for you.
Eddie looked confused.
The diner, she said. She pointed to the speck of light in the mountains. It's there because I wanted to return to my younger years, a simple but secure life. And I wanted all those who had ever suffered at Ruby Pier, every accident, every fire, every fight, slip and fall, to be safe and secure. I wanted them all like I wanted my Emil, warm, well-fed, in the cradle of a welcoming place far from the sea.
Ruby stood and Eddie stood too. He could not stop thinking about his father's death.
I hated him, he mumbled.
The old woman nodded.
He was hell on me as a kid, and he was worse when I got older.
Ruby stepped toward him. Edward, she said softly.
It was the first time she had called him by name.
Learn this from me. Holding anger is a poison. It eats you from inside. We think that hating is a weapon that attacks the person who harmed us. But hatred is a curved blade, and the harm we do to ourselves. Forgive, Edward. Forgive. Do you remember the lightness you felt when you first arrived in heaven?
Eddie did. Where is my pain?
That's because no one is born in anger, and when we die, the soul is freed of it. But now, here, in order to move on, you must understand why you felt what you did and why you no longer need to feel it. She touched his hand. You need to forgive your father.
Eddie thought about the years that followed his father's funeral, how he never achieved anything, how he never went anywhere. For all that time, Eddie had imagined a certain life, a could-have-been life, that would have been his, if not for his father's death and his mother's subsequent collapse. Over the years, he glorified that imaginary life and held his father accountable for all of its losses, the loss of freedom, the loss of career, the loss of hope. He never rose above the dirty, tiresome work his father had left behind.
When he died, Eddie said, he took part of me with him. I was stuck after that.
Ruby shook her head.
Your father, is not the reason you never left the pier.
Eddie looked up.
Then what is?
She patted her skirt. She adjusted her spectacles. She began to walk away.
There are still two people for you to meet, she said.
Eddie tried to say, wait, but a cold wind nearly ripped the voice from his throat. Then everything went black. Ruby was gone. He was back atop the mountain, outside the diner, standing in the snow. He stood there for a long time, alone in the silence, until he realized the old woman was not coming back. Then he turned to the door and slowly pulled it open. He heard clanking silverware and dishes being stacked. He smelled freshly cooked food, breads and meats and sauces. The spirits of those who had perished at the pier were all around, engaged with one another, eating and drinking and talking. Eddie moved haltingly, knowing what he was there to do. He turned to his right, to the corner booth, to the ghost of his father smoking a cigar. He felt a shiver. He thought about the old man hanging out that hospital window, dying alone in the middle of the night.
Dad,
Eddie whispered. His father could not hear him. Eddie drew closer.
Dad, I know what happened now.
He felt a choke in his chest. He dropped to his knees alongside the booth. His father was so close that Eddie could see the whiskers on his face and the frayed end of his cigar. He saw the baggy lines beneath his tired eyes, the bent nose, the bony knuckles and squared shoulders of a working man. He looked at his own arms and realized, in his earthly body, he was now older than his father. He had outlived him in every way.
I was angry with you, Dad. I hated you.
Eddie felt tears welling. He felt a shaking in his chest. Something was flushing out of him.
You beat me. You shut me out. I didn't understand. I still don't understand. Why did you do it? Why?
He drew in long, painful breaths.
I didn't know, okay? I didn't know your life, what happened. I didn't know you. But you're my father. I let it go now, all right? All right? Can we let it go?
His voice wobbled until it was high and wailing, not his own anymore.
Okay? You hear me?
He screamed, then softer.
You hear me, Dad?
He leaned in close. He saw his father's dirty hands. He spoke the last familiar words in a whisper.
It's fixed.
Eddie pounded the table and slumped to the floor. When he looked up, he saw Ruby standing across the way, young and beautiful. She dipped her head, opened the door, and lifted off into the jade sky. Thursday, 11 a.m. Who would pay for Eddie's funeral? He had no relatives. He'd left no instructions. His body remained at the city morgue, as did his clothes and personal effects, his maintenance shirt, his socks and shoes, his linen cap, his wedding ring, his cigarettes and pipe cleaners, all awaiting claim. In the end, Mr. Bullock, the park owner, footed the bill, using the money he saved from Eddie's no longer cashable paycheck. The casket was a wooden box. The church was chosen by location, the one nearest the pier, as most attendees had to get back to work. A few minutes before the service, the pastor asked Dominguez, wearing a navy blue sport coat and his good black jeans, to step inside his office. "Could you share some of the deceased's unique qualities?" the pastor asked. "I understand you worked with him." Dominguez swallowed. He was none too comfortable with clergymen. He hooked his fingers together earnestly as if giving the matter some thought, and spoke as softly as he thought one should speak in such a situation. He finally said, "Eddie really loved his wife." He unhooked his fingers, then quickly added, "Of course, I never met her." Chapter 13. The fourth person Eddie meets in heaven. Eddie blinked and found himself in a small round room. The mountains were gone, and so was the jade sky. A low plaster ceiling just missed his head. The room was brown, as plain as shipping wrap, and empty, save for a wooden stool and an oval mirror on the wall. Eddie stepped in front of the mirror. He cast no reflection. He saw only the reverse of the room, which expanded suddenly to include a row of doors. Eddie turned around. Then he coughed. The sound startled him as if it came from someone else. He coughed again, a hard, rumbling cough, as if things needed to be resettled in his chest. When did this start, Eddie thought. He touched his skin, which had aged since his time with Ruby. It felt thinner now and drier. His midsection, which during his time with the captain had felt as tight as pulled rubber, was loose with flab, the droop of age. "There are still two people for you to meet," Ruby had said. And then what? His lower back had a dull ache. His bad leg was growing stiffer. He realized what was happening. It happened with each new stage of heaven. He was rotting away. He approached one of the doors and pushed it open. Suddenly he was outside, in the yard of a home he had never seen, in a land that he did not recognize, in the midst of what appeared to be a wedding reception. Guests holding silver plates filled the grassy lawn. At one end stood an archway covered in red flowers and birch branches, and at the other end, next to Eddie, stood the door that he had walked through. The bride, young and pretty, was in the center of the group, removing a pin from her butter-colored hair. The groom was lanky. He wore a black wedding coat and held up a sword, and at the hilt of the sword was a ring. He lowered it toward the bride, and guests cheered as she took it. Eddie heard their voices, but the language was foreign. German, Swedish. He coughed again. The group looked up. Every person seemed to smile, and the smiling frightened Eddie. He backed quickly through the door from which he'd entered, figuring to return to the round room. Instead, he was in the middle of another wedding, indoors this time, in a large hall where the people looked Spanish and the bride wore orange blossoms in her hair. She was dancing from one partner to the next, and each guest handed her a small sack of coins. Eddie coughed again. He couldn't help it. And when several of the guests looked up, he backed through the door and again entered a different wedding scene. Something African, Eddie guessed, where families poured wine onto the ground and the couple held hands and jumped over a broom. Then another passed through the door to a Chinese reception where firecrackers were lit before cheering attendees. Then another doorway to something else, maybe French, where the couple drank together from a two-handled cup. "How long does this go on?" Eddie thought. In each reception, there were no signs of how the people had gotten there, no cars or buses, no wagons, no horses. Departure did not appear to be an issue. The guests milled about, and Eddie was absorbed as one of them, smiled at but never spoken to, much like the handful of weddings he had gone to on Earth. He preferred it that way. Weddings were, in Eddie's mind, too full of embarrassing moments, like when couples were asked to join in a dance or to help lift the bride in a chair. His bad leg seemed to glow at those moments, and he felt as if people could see it from across the room. Because of that, Eddie avoided most receptions, and when he did go, he often stood in the parking lot, smoking a cigarette, waiting for time to pass. For a long stretch, there were no weddings to attend anyhow. Only in the late years of his life, when some of his teenage peer workers had grown up and taken spouses, did he find himself getting the faded suit out of the closet and putting on the collared shirt that pinched his thick neck. By this point, his once fractured leg bones were spurred and deformed. Arthritis had invaded his knee. He limped badly and was thus excused from all participatory moments, such as dances or candle lightings. He was considered an old man, alone, unattached, and no one expected him to do much besides smile when the photographer came to the table. Here, now in his maintenance clothes, he moved from one wedding to the next, one reception to another, one language, one cake, and one type of music, to another language, another cake, and another type of music. The uniformity did not surprise Eddie. He always figured a wedding here was not much different from a wedding there. What he didn't get was what this had to do with him. He pushed through the threshold one more time and found himself in what appeared to be an Italian village. There were vineyards on the hillsides and farmhouses of travertine stone. Many of the men had thick black hair, combed back and wet, and the women had dark eyes and sharp features. Eddie found a place against a wall and watched the bride and groom cut a log in half with a two-handed ripsaw. Music played. Flutists, violinists, guitarists. And guests began the tarantella, dancing in a wild, twirling rhythm.
Eddie took a few steps back. His eyes wandered to the edge of the crowd. A bridesmaid in a long lavender dress and a stitched straw hat moved through the guests with a basket of candy-covered almonds. From afar, she looked to be in her 20s. "Per l'amaro e il dolce," she said, offering her sweets. "Per l'amaro e il dolce. Per l'amaro e il dolce." At the sound of her voice, Eddie's whole body shook. He began to sweat. Something told him to run, but something else froze his feet to the ground. She came his way. Her eyes found him from beneath the hat brim, which was topped with parchment flowers. "Per l'amaro e il dolce," she said, smiling, holding out the almonds. "For the bitter and the sweet." Her dark hair fell over one eye, and Eddie's heart nearly burst. His lips took a moment to part, and the sound from the back of his throat took a moment to rise, but they came together in the first letter of the only name that ever made him feel this way. He dropped to his knees.
"Marguerite," he whispered.
"For the bitter and the sweet," she said. Today is Eddie's birthday. Eddie and his brother are sitting in the maintenance shop.
"This," Joe says proudly, holding up a drill, "is the newest model."
Joe is wearing a checkered sport coat and black and white saddle shoes. Eddie thinks his brother looks too fancy, and fancy means phony. But Joe is a salesman for a hardware company now, and Eddie has been wearing the same outfit for years, so what does he know?
"Yes, sir," Joe says, "and get this, it runs on that battery."
Eddie holds the battery between his fingers, a small thing called nickel cadmium. Hard to believe.
"Start it up," Joe says, handing the drill over.
Eddie squeezes the trigger. It explodes in noise.
"Nice, huh?" Joe yells.
That morning, Joe had told Eddie his new salary. It was 3 times what Eddie made. Then Joe had congratulated Eddie on his promotion, head of maintenance for Ruby Pier, his father's old position.
Eddie had wanted to answer, "If it's so great, why don't you take it and I'll take your job?"
But he didn't. Eddie never said anything he felt that deeply. "Hello, anybody in here?" Marguerite is at the door holding a reel of orange tickets. Eddie's eyes go, as always, to her face, her olive skin, her dark coffee eyes. She has taken a job in the ticket booths this summer, and she wears the official Ruby Pier uniform, a white shirt, a red vest, black stirrup pants, a red beret, and her name on a pin below her collarbone. The sight of it makes Eddie angry, especially in front of his hotshot brother.
"Show her the drill," Joe says. He turns to Marguerite. "It's battery operated."
Eddie squeezes. Marguerite grabs her ears.
"It's louder than your snoring," she says. "Whoa," Joe yells, laughing. "Whoa, she got you."
Eddie looks down sheepishly, then sees his wife smiling.
"Can you come outside?" she says.
Eddie waves the drill.
"I'm working here."
"Just for a minute, okay?" Eddie stands up slowly, then follows her out the door. The sun hits his face.
"Happy birthday, Mr. Eddie,"
a group of children scream in unison.
"Well, I'll be," Eddie says.
Marguerite yells, "Okay, kids, put the candles on the cake." The children race to a vanilla sheet cake sitting on a nearby folding table. Marguerite leans towards Eddie and whispers,
"I promised them you'd blow out all 38 at once."
Eddie snorts. He watches his wife organize the group. As always with Marguerite and children, his mood is lifted by her easy connection to them and dampened by her inability to bear them. One doctor said she was too nervous. Another said she had waited too long. She should have had them by age 25. In time, they ran out of money for doctors. It was what it was. For nearly a year now, she has been talking about adoption. She went to the library. She brought home papers. Eddie said they were too old. She said, "What's too old to a child?" Eddie said he'd think about it.
"All right," she yells now from the sheet cake. "Come on, Mr. Eddie. Blow them out. Oh, wait, wait."
She fishes in a bag and pulls out a camera, a complicated contraption with rods and tabs and a round flashbulb.
"Charlene let me use it. It's a Polaroid."
Marguerite lines up the picture, Eddie over the cake, the children squeezing in around him, admiring the 38 little flames. One kid pokes Eddie and says,
"Blow them all out, okay?"
Eddie looks down.
The frosting is a mess, full of countless little handprints.
I will, Eddie says, but he's looking at his wife.
Chapter 14. Eddie stared at the young Marguerite.
It's not you, he said.
She lowered her almond basket. She smiled sadly. The tarantella was dancing behind them, and the sun was fading behind a ribbon of white clouds.
It's not you, Eddie said again.
The dancers yelled, "Hooray!" They banged tambourines. She offered her hand. Eddie reached for it quickly, instinctively, as if grabbing for a falling object. Their fingers met, and he had never felt such a sensation, as if flesh were forming over his own flesh, soft and warm and almost ticklish. She knelt down beside him.
It's not you, he said.
It is me, she whispered.
Hooey! It's not you, it's not you, it's not you,
Eddie mumbled as he dropped his head onto her shoulder and for the first time since his death began to cry. Their own wedding took place Christmas Eve on the second floor of a dimly lit Chinese restaurant called Sammy Hong's. The owner, Sammy, agreed to rent it for that night, figuring he'd have little other business. Eddie took what cash he had left from the army and spent it on the reception. Roast chicken and Chinese vegetables and port wine and a man with an accordion. The chairs for the ceremony were needed for the dinner, so once the vows were taken, the waiters asked the guests to rise, then carried the chairs downstairs to the tables. The accordion man sat on a stool. Years later, Marguerite would joke that the only thing missing from their wedding were the bingo cards. When the meal was finished and some small gifts were given, a final toast was offered and the accordion man packed his case. Eddie and Marguerite left through the front door. It was raining lightly, a chilly rain, but the bride and groom walked home together, seeing as it was only a few blocks. Marguerite wore her wedding dress beneath a thick pink sweater. Eddie wore his white suit coat, the shirt pinching his neck. They held hands. They moved through pools of lamplight. Everything around them seemed buttoned up tight. People say they find love as if it were an object hidden by a rock. But love takes many forms, and it is never the same for any man and woman. What people find then is a certain love, and Eddie found a certain love with Marguerite. A grateful love, a deep but quiet love, one that he knew, above all else, was irreplaceable. Once she'd gone, he'd let the days go stale. He put his heart to sleep. Now here she was again, as young as the day they were wed. "Walk with me," she said. Eddie tried to stand, but his bad knee buckled. She lifted him effortlessly. "Your leg," she said, regarding the faded scar with a tender familiarity. Then she looked up and touched the tufts of hair above his ears. "It's white," she said, smiling. Eddie couldn't get his tongue to move. He couldn't do much but stare. She was exactly as he remembered. More beautiful, really, for his final memories of her had been as an older, suffering woman. He stood beside her, silent, until her dark eyes narrowed and her lips crept up mischievously. "Eddie?" She almost giggled. "Have you forgotten so fast how I used to look?" Eddie swallowed.
"I never forgot that."
She touched his face lightly and the warmth spread through his body. She motioned to the village and the dancing guests. "All weddings," she said happily. "That was my choice. A world of weddings behind every door. Oh, Eddie, it never changes. When the groom lifts the veil, when the bride accepts the ring, the possibilities you see in their eyes. It's the same around the world. They truly believe their love and their marriage is going to break all the records." She smiled. "Do you think we had that?" Eddie didn't know how to answer.
"We had an accordion player," he said.
They walked from the reception and up a gravel path. The music faded to a background noise. Eddie wanted to tell her everything he had seen, everything that had happened. He wanted to ask her about every little thing and every big thing, too. He felt a churning inside him, a stop-start anxiety. He had no idea where to begin.
"You did this, too?"
he finally said.
"You met five people?"
She nodded.
"A different five people?"
he said. She nodded again.
And they explained everything, and it made a difference?
She smiled. All the difference. She touched his chin. And then I waited for you. He studied her eyes, her smile. He wondered if her waiting had felt like his.
How much do you know about me? I mean, how much do you know since...
He still had trouble saying it. Since you died. She removed the straw hat and pushed the thick young locks away from her forehead. Well, I know everything that happened when we were together. She pursed her lips. And now I know why it happened. She put her hands on her chest. And I also know that you loved me dearly. She took his other hand then. He felt the melting warmth. I don't know how you died, she said.
Eddie thought for a moment.
I'm not sure either, he said. There was a girl, a little girl. She wandered into this ride and she was in trouble.
Marguerite's gaze widened. She looked so young. This was harder than Eddie figured, telling his wife about the day he was killed.
They have these rides, see, these new rides. Nothing like we used to have. Everything has to go 1,000 miles an hour now. Anyhow, this one ride, it drops these carts, and the hydraulics are supposed to stop it, bring it down slowly, but something sliced the cable, the cart snapped loose. I still can't figure it, but the cart dropped because I told him to release it. I mean, I told Dom, he's this kid who works for me now. It wasn't his fault, but I told him, and then I tried to stop it, but he couldn't hear me, and this little girl was just sitting there, and I tried to reach her. I tried to save her. I felt her little hands, but then I...
He stopped. She tilted her head, urging him to go on. He exhaled deeply.
I ain't talked this much since I got here, he said.
She nodded and smiled, a gentle smile, and at the sight of it his eyes began to moisten, and a wave of sadness washed over him. And suddenly, just like that, none of this mattered. Nothing about his death, or the park, or the crowd he had yelled at to get back. Why was he talking about this? What was he doing? Was he really with her? Like a hidden grieving that rises to grab the heart, his soul was ambushed with old emotions, and his lips began to tremble, and he was swept into the current of all that he had lost. He was looking at his wife, his dead wife, his young wife, his missing wife, his only wife, and he didn't want to look anymore.
Oh, God, Marguerite, he whispered. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I can't say. I can't say. I can't say.
He dropped his head into his hands, and he said it anyhow. He said what everyone says.
I missed you so much.
Today is Eddie's birthday. The racetrack is crowded with summer customers. The women wear straw sun hats and the men smoke cigars. Eddie and Noel leave work early to play Eddie's birthday number 39 in the Daily Double. They sit on slatted fold-down seats. At their feet are paper cups of beer amidst a carpet of discarded tickets. Earlier, Eddie won the first race of the day. He'd put half of those winnings on the second race, and won that as well, the first time such a thing had ever happened to him. That gave him $209. After losing twice in smaller bets, he put it all on a horse to win in the sixth, because, as he and Noel agreed, in exuberant logic, he'd arrive with next to nothing, so what harm done if he went home the same way?
Just think, if you win, Noel says now, you'll have all that dough for the kid.
The bell rings, the horses are off. They bunch together on the far straightaway, their colorful silks blurring with their bumpy movement. Eddie has number 8, a horse named Jersey Finch, which isn't a bad gamble, not at 4-1, but what Noel has just said about the kid, the one Eddie and Marguerite are planning to adopt, flushes him with guilt. They could have used that money. Why did he do things like this? The crowd rises, the horses come down the stretch. Jersey Finch moves outside and lengthens into full stride. The cheering mixes with the thundering hooves. Noel hollers. Eddie squeezes his ticket. He's more nervous than he wants to be. His skin goes bumpy. One horse pulls ahead of the pack. Jersey Finch! Now Eddie has nearly $800.
I gotta call home, he says.
You'll ruin it, Noel says.
What are you talking about?
You tell somebody, you ruin your luck.
You're nuts.
Don't do it.
I'm calling her. It'll make her happy. It won't make her happy.
He limps to a payphone and drops in a nickel. Marguerite answers. Eddie tells her the news.
Nola's right. She is not happy.
She tells him to come home. He tells her to stop telling him what to do.
We have a baby coming, she scolds. You can't keep behaving like this.
Eddie hangs up the phone with a heap behind his ears. He goes back to Noel, who is eating peanuts at the railing.
Let me guess, Noel says.
They go to the window and pick another horse. Eddie takes the money from his pocket. Half of him doesn't want it anymore, and half of him wants twice as much, so he can throw it on the bed when he gets home and tell his wife,
here, buy whatever you want, okay?
Noel watches him push the bills through the opening. He raises his eyebrows.
I know, Eddie says.
What he does not know is that Marguerite, unable to call him back, has chosen to drive to the track and find him. She feels badly about yelling, this being his birthday, and she wants to apologize. She also wants him to stop. She knows from evenings past that Noel will insist they stay until closing. Noel is like that. And since the track is only 10 minutes away, she grabs her handbag and drives their second-hand Nash Rambler down Ocean Parkway. She turns right on Leicester Street. The sun is gone and the sky is in flux. Most of the cars are coming from the other direction. She approaches the Leicester Street overpass, which used to be how customers reached the track, up the stairs, over the street, and back down the stairs again, until the track owners paid the city for a traffic light, which left the overpass, for the most part, deserted. But on this night, it is not deserted. It holds two teenagers who do not want to be found, two 17-year-olds who hours earlier have been chased from a liquor store after stealing 5 cartons of cigarettes and 3 pints of Old Harper's whiskey. Now, having finished the alcohol and smoked many of the cigarettes, they are bored with the evening, and they dangle their empty bottles over the lip of the rusted railing.
Dare me?
One says.
Dare you, says the other.
The first one lets the bottle drop, and they duck behind the metal grate to watch. It just misses a car and shatters onto the pavement.
Woohoo! The second one yells, did you see that? Drop yours now, chicken!
The second one stands, holds out his bottle, and chooses the sparse traffic of the right-hand lane. He wiggles the bottle back and forth, trying to time the drop to land between vehicles, as if this was some sort of art and he was some sort of artist. His fingers release. He almost smiles. 40 feet below, Marguerite never thinks to look up, never thinks that anything might be happening on that overpass, never thinks about anything besides getting Eddie out of that racetrack while he still has some money left. She is wondering what section of the grandstand to look in, even as the Old Harper's whiskey bottle smashes her windshield into a spray of flying glass. Her car veers into the concrete divider. Her body is tossed like a doll, slamming against the door and the dashboard and the steering wheel, lacerating her liver and breaking her arm and thumping her head so hard she loses touch with the sounds of the evening. She does not hear the screeching of cars. She does not hear the honking of horns. She does not hear the retreat of rubber-soled sneakers running down the Leicester Street overpass and off into the night. Chapter 15. Love, like rain, can nourish from above, drenching couples with a soaking joy. But sometimes, under the angry heat of life, love dries on the surface and must nourish from below, tending to its roots, keeping itself alive. The accident on Leicester Street sent Marguerite to the hospital. She was confined to bed rest for nearly 6 months. Her injured liver recovered eventually, but the expense and the delay cost them the adoption. The child they were expecting went to someone else. The unspoken blame for this never found a resting place. It simply moved like a shadow from husband to wife. Marguerite went quiet for a long time. Eddie lost himself in work. The shadow took a place at their table, and they ate in its presence, amid the lonely clanking of forks and plates. When they spoke of small things. The water of their love was hidden beneath the roots. Eddie never bet the horses again. His visits with Noel came to a gradual end, each of them unable to discuss much over breakfast that didn't feel like an effort. An amusement park in California introduced the first tubular steel tracks. They twisted at severe angles, unachievable with wood. And suddenly roller coasters, which had faded to near oblivion, were back in fashion. Mr. Bullock, the park owner, had ordered a steel track model for Ruby Pier, and Eddie oversaw the construction. He barked at the installers, checking their every move. He didn't trust anything this fast. 60-degree angles? He was sure someone would get hurt. Anyhow, it gave him a distraction. The Stardust Bandshell was torn down. So was the Zipper Ride and the Tunnel of Love, which kids found too corny now. A few years later, a new boat ride called a Log Flume was constructed, and to Eddie's surprise, it was hugely popular. The riders floated through troughs of water and dropped at the end into a large splash pool. Eddie couldn't figure why people so loved getting wet when the ocean was 300 yards away. But he maintained it just the same, working shoeless in the water, ensuring that the boats never loosened from the tracks. In time, husband and wife began talking again, and one night Eddie even spoke about adopting. Marguerite rubbed her forehead and said, "We're too old now." Eddie said, "What's too old to a child?" The years passed, and while a child never came, their wounds slowly healed, and their companionship rose to fill the space they were saving for another. In the morning, she made him toast and coffee, and he dropped her at her cleaning job, then drove back to the pier. Sometimes in the afternoon, she got off early and walked the boardwalk with him, following his rounds, riding carousel horses or yellow-painted clamshells, as Eddie explained the rotors and cables and listened for the engine's hum. One July evening, they found themselves walking by the ocean, eating grape popsicles, their bare feet sinking in the wet sand. They looked around and realized they were the oldest people on the beach. Marguerite said something about the bikini bathing suits the young girls were wearing and how she would never have the nerve to wear such a thing. Eddie said the girls were lucky because if she did, the men would not look at anyone else. And even though by this point Marguerite was in her mid-40s and her hips had thickened and a web of small lines had formed around her eyes, she thanked Eddie gratefully and looked at his crooked nose and wide jaw. The waters of their love fell again from above and soaked them as surely as the sea that gathered at their feet. 3 years later, she was breading chicken cutlets in the kitchen of their apartment, the one that they had kept all this time, long after Eddie's mother had died, because Marguerite said it reminded her of when they were kids, and she liked to see the old carousel out the window. Suddenly, without warning, the fingers of her right hand stretched open uncontrollably. They moved backward. They would not close. The cutlet slid from her palm. It fell into the sink. Her arm throbbed. Her breathing quickened. She stared for a moment at this hand with the locked fingers that appeared to belong to someone else, someone gripping a large, invisible jar. Then everything went dizzy. "Eddie," she called, but by the time he arrived, she had passed out on the floor. It was, they would determine, a tumor on the brain, and her decline would be like many others, treatments that made the disease seem mild, hair falling out in patches, mornings spent with noisy radiation machines, and evenings spent vomiting in a hospital toilet. In the final days, when cancer was ruled the victor, the doctors said only, "Rest, take it easy." When she asked questions, they nodded sympathetically, as if their nods were medicine doled out with a dropper. She realized this was protocol, their way of being nice while being helpless. And when one of them suggested getting your affairs in order, she asked to be released from the hospital. She told more than asked. Eddie helped her up the stairs and hung her coat as she looked around the apartment. She wanted to cook, but he made her sit, and he heated some water for tea. He had purchased lamb chops the day before, and that night he bumbled through a dinner with several invited friends and co-workers, most of whom greeted Marguerite and her sallow complexion with sentences like, "Well, look who's back," as if this were a homecoming and not a farewell party. They ate mashed potatoes from a Corningware dish and had butterscotch brownies for dessert, and when Marguerite finished a second glass of wine, Eddie took the bottle and poured her a third. 2 days later, she awoke with a scream. He drove her to the hospital in the pre-dawn silence. They spoke in short sentences, what doctor might be on, who Eddie should call. And even though she was sitting in the seat next to him, Eddie felt her in everything, in the steering wheel, in the gas pedal, in the blinking of his eye, in the clearing of his throat. Every move he made was about hanging on to her. She was 47. "You have the card?" she asked him.
"The card?" he said blankly.
She drew a deep breath and closed her eyes, and her voice was thinner when she resumed speaking, as if that breath had cost her dearly.
"Insurance," she croaked. "Yeah, yeah," he said quickly. "I got the card."
They parked in the lot and Eddie shut the engine. It was suddenly too still and too quiet. He heard every tiny sound, the squeak of his body on the leather seat